Ephesians chapter 4, beginning with verses 1 through 16, we now look at how we love each other within the church. Hear the word of the Lord. I, therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to one hope that belongs to your call. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. But grace was given to each one of us according to the measure of Christ's gift. Therefore it says, when he ascended on high, he had led a host of captives, and he gave gifts to men. In saying he ascended, what does it mean? But that he had also descended to the lower regions, the earth. He who descended is the one who also ascended far above all the heavens, that he might fill all things. And he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, and the teachers to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ, until we all attain to the unity of faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, so that we may no longer be children tossed to and fro by the waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by human cunning, by craftiness and deceitful schemes. Rather, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way unto Him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and held together by every joint with which it is equipped, when each part is working properly, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up in love. This thus ends the reading of God's Word. All men are like grass, and all of our glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers and the flowers fall, but not God's Word. God's Word lasts forever. Let's give our attention to it. There's a major change in today's text. In Paul's letters, they always begin with a large section of declarations. This is who God is. This is how He loves you. And in each of his letters, there is an enormous therefore. And after the therefore, there is a list of exhortations. Based upon how you are loved, live like this. And you can point to them. If you know his letters well, you know where they are. Romans, it comes in chapter 12. In Ephesians, it comes in chapter 4. And he says, I, a prisoner of the Lord, therefore implore you. And so we're going to begin looking at what his exhortations are. And the first exhortation he gives us is, live together in the church in unity. Live in the church in unity. One of the coolest places I've ever been is in St. Louis. It's called City Museum. Typically the word cool and museum don't go in the same sentence with me. It's got to have like shooting or football for me to think it's cool. But City Museum is actually not a museum in any way, shape, form, or fashion. It's a terrible name. It's a playground, essentially, is what it is. And it's got five floors to it. It's got a three-story slide. It's got all these incredible things. And in it, there are a few sculptures. There's one of a sea turtle and a couple of other things. And I remember the sea turtle well because you see it from a distance and you think, oh, that's kind of cool. Whatever, you know, it's a turtle. And you get up close and you realize it's made from trash. It is made, the entire playground, this five-story museum, is all put together from broken bottles, from discarded rollers, from packing plants, from thrown away copper wire, from old parts of cranes, old school buses. Everything in there has been thrown away by somebody else. And it kind of makes you do a double take. Like, you're looking at the sculpture and you think, okay, that's a whole lot cooler than I thought it was. Because it really does look like a sea turtle, which is cool. But it looks like a sea turtle that's been made from refuse. And so now you're just amazed at the artisan. How did you do that? What I want you to understand is this, and I hate to front load a sermon, But essentially, I've got one profound thing to say in this one, and here it is. Okay, so listen up, and then you can take the next 20 minutes off. Understanding the material will dictate how happy you are in the church. What God is doing in His church is He is building a sculpture, an image of His Son. And He is not building that sculpture from a piece of marble. If you think of Him as being like Michelangelo, going out and finding an unblemished, perfect piece of marble and kind of taking the bad pieces away and leaving the beauty there behind, you will always be mad at the church. That is not what He is doing. He is taking refuse, broken bits of glass, a piece of charcoal snatched from the fire, a piece of broken stone that's been kind of removed from the bedrock stone and just been floating around useless. And He's taking those broken stones and those petrified pieces of wood and He's polishing them up. And that polishing is a process called sanctification. It doesn't feel real good. We'll talk about that next week. And He's placing them in His sculpture. And He's making something beautiful out of all of us who have been cast off. You must understand that. You must understand that God isn't starting with something beautiful and making it more beautiful. He is starting with something that is broken and destroyed and cast off and bringing them together to make something beautiful. It's completely different. If you don't understand that, then you're going to walk into the door of this church or any church and wonder, why is nobody paying attention to me? Why is nobody meeting my needs? Why is nobody asking me how my week has been? Why has no one rushed to the door to talk to me? Why are all my friends not here? Why is this place so broken? And if we were a perfect piece of marble, then you would have a very valid point. But there ain't no marble in here. And what you have to understand in this and every other church is that everybody who's walked in that door in the last 2 hours has wondered why no one is talking to them. Everybody who's walked in that door has come in afraid that nobody in here would be happy to see them. Everybody who's come in that door has been afraid that if you really knew me, you wouldn't want me here. Everybody who's walked in is broken. And God is not breaking something that is beautiful, He's making something beautiful out of something that's broken. That's the same thing He's doing with the whole world, and it's tempting for us to forget that. It's very tempting for us to forget that. When bad news comes out, and we find out that somebody that we love is actually a whole lot more broken than we thought, our temptation is to get mad at God and ask God, why can't you give us a break? Why have you crushed somebody who was good? When in reality, God says, I think you've got it backwards. I'm trying to make something beautiful out of somebody who was crushed. And that's not an easy process. And that takes patience. And that takes time. And sometimes it means I'm going to bring things to the surface that you would really a whole lot rather keep under the surface. And sometimes that's going to mean that people in the church don't treat us the way we feel like we ought to be treated. And I want you to understand that everybody in here is broken. And you will only be able to love your church and maintain unity in your church if you know that. And the question really is, how in the world can we function and maintain peace and unity and grace in a community full of broken and selfish people? And there is that is what this text is about. It is about maintaining unity in the church. And Paul tells us, essentially, he gives us kind of a schematic for a Greek temple, if you want. He says, you have to remember that you're a building, and you're a building for a purpose. You're a temple. And if you went into those Greek temples, you would realize there were three essential things to them. There was the the image in the middle of the temple, and everything pointed to that. There was the stones around with which the temple were built, and there is a ton, just an enormous amount of mortar and glue holding everything together. And that's what we're going to do today. We're going to look first at the image, then at the stones of truth, and finally at the mortar. And the first thing I want you to see is the purpose of the temple is the image. It is for Christ. Everything is for Him. Everything is for Him. He is, there is one body and one spirit. Verse 5, there is one Lord, one faith, one baptism. Verse 7, grace was given to each one of us according to the measure of Christ's gifts. It is Christ who ascended to achieve the victory over sin and death. It is Christ who descended to face all the pain of sin and the shame that sin deserved. He is the one who gave the apostles and the prophets, and He is the one we are growing into, the head. It is from Christ, and it is to Christ. Everything about the church is from Him and for Him. When you walk into those temples, there's actually, I know a little bit about Greek temples because there's actually one in Nashville. I don't know if you know this. Kind of an odd place. You wouldn't expect a Greek temple to be in Nashville, but it's there, Centennial Park, right across from Vanderbilt. And the interesting thing about the way those things were built is this. Everything about them was designed to point your attention to the image. All of the artwork that you looked at, kind of your eyes would follow it to the middle of the temple. All of the hallways, no matter where you entered it, there's steps all around it, but no matter where you entered it, you were going, if you walked at all, if you moved at all, you were going to be moving toward the center. You had to walk through the center. Even the acoustics. If you were inside of the temple anywhere and you spoke, your voice would go up into around the ceiling and it would come back to you from the middle. It would sound as if no matter who was speaking, it would sound as if they were talking from the center. Everything was focused to turn your attention to the image. And you have to understand that is what we're doing in Christ. Everything. Everything that we relate to, the way we relate to each other, everything we do is from Christ and it's for Him. Everything about the church is from Christ and it is for Him. I got a phone call this week actually from a friend of mine who I went to seminary with, and he was standing at the grave of one of our mentors, an old pastor named John Reed Miller. And Dr. Miller was a pastor at First Presbyterian Church in Jackson from 1952 to 1969. And after that, he would just meet with students for years and years and years. And my friend and I were the two last students that he met with. He would adopt seminary students and let us take him to lunch and share with us his wisdom. And one story he always loved to tell, he always loved to tell the story of someone who came up to him, a pastor of a small church, who came to him near the end of his ministry, and it was basically saying he's sorry that he never got to preach in a big church during his career. And Dr. Miller, he had no idea who he was talking to, because Dr. Miller looked at him and said, "What do you mean big church?" And the guy said, "Well, you know, I mean, I've always kind of pastored a small church, done missions conferences in small churches. I've always spoken to small churches." And Dr. Miller looked at him with tears running down his face, going, "There's no small church. There's no big church. There is only Christ's church. This church, First Church, is not my church. I didn't die for this church. I didn't save this church. I didn't call anybody to this church. It's Christ's church. There is only one church. It is Christ's church." You must understand this. About any church you ever walk into, there is only one. There is only one. There is Christ's church. He alone died for it. He alone saves it. He alone upholds it by His Spirit. He alone enlivens it by His presence. There is only one church. And everything is from Him, and everything is to Him. And you have to understand that. That the key to our unity, the key to our unity is understanding that. The key to our unity is understanding that. I went to a college that was kind of in the heyday of trying to be liberal. It was trying to be liberal. It was doing a very bad job of it, but it was trying. And when I was at Vanderbilt, all they talked about was multiculturalism and unity within diversity. And it was very important that we understand that. And I mean, everything. It was multicultural unions and projects on campus. And it was an abysmal failure. And they talked about it a lot. They preached a lot to us. We had different, an Asian student union, an African-American student union, a gay student union, and we had fraternity houses, which were the, white upper-class student unions. And everybody kind of went to their union. And all they talked about was unity, and all we ever saw was diversity. And nobody really got along with anybody they weren't already like. Then I went from there to an extremely conservative seminary. When I was at Reformed Seminary, Christianity Today said it was the most conservative seminary in the country. So, yay me. I guess, whatever. While I was there, I did not hear a single lesson on diversity or multiculturalism. Not one. But I did look around one day and realized that in the middle of my class on the Holy Trinity, every continent on earth was represented. Except Antarctica. No penguins. But every peopled continent on earth was represented. And not only was there great diversity from every place in the world, but unbelievable diversity of the people who were in there. You see, we had Kurt Presley, who's probably a descendant of Elvis Presley, Tupelo, Mississippi, Ole Miss, undergraduate, Vanderbilt Law School, who decided to leave being a lawyer to become a pastor. And we had David, whose last name I couldn't pronounce, and David wasn't really his name, he just gave us a name that we could pronounce, who was from Nagaland, a former headhunter. We had diversity. As far and as separate as you could possibly be. We had people as completely different with nothing, not a single thing they could talk about except for Jesus. And that is where unity comes from. Unity comes from not talking about yourself at all, but surrounding the one who has saved you. And that's why we are here today. We are not here to talk about child care or different kinds of projects. We are here because everyone in this room shares a common story. We live for something. We live for success or for pleasure or for relationships. We believe we were nobody until somebody loved us. And whatever we were living for, whether it be the approval of our parents or the approval of the world through our grades, or just the approval of our flesh by just staying as drunk as we could, as long as we could, whatever it was, failed us. And it was destroying us. And Jesus saved us out of that. And He taught us what it means that we were loved simply because we're members of His family. And there is no life anywhere else. He is the center of our community, and He is the key to our community. And I want you to understand this. The second you forget that we are here for Jesus, you will begin to hate this or any other church. And there's 1,000 things we could do to make this church more fun for you, and we're not going to do any of them. Unless I want them. I'm just kidding. We are not here for you. And we're not saying that we're not here for you to be mean and to be self-righteous and be like, oh, we're so much better than all those other churches that do think they're here for you. We are not here for you, and we are projecting, that we're proclaiming the fact that we're not here for you because of this. If you think we are, you will be bitter. If you think the world exists for you, then every day you're going to get mad that you didn't get what you believed you had coming to you that day. Because guess what? The world's not here for you. It's not. And God has got a purpose to this world, and that purpose is to bring glory to His Son. And that is the flow of history. That is where it's going. And if you get captured in that, and all of a sudden it becomes your goal in life to see that, then you will wake up in the morning pleased with whatever God sends you, because it is getting us to the glory of His Son. But if you forget that, then you're going to wake up in the world morning mad that more people aren't recognizing how great you are. And you'll grow bitter. And our service to you is to remind you that we're not here for you. We are here for Jesus. Christ is not only the image of this temple, He's also the architect and the contractor. He won't leave anything to anybody else, will He? He's the one who designs it. And He puts the pieces in place. And He's the one who is building it. He talks about how He builds it. He says He ascended in the high, and He led captives captive, and He gave the spoil to men. I love the way Eugene Peterson describes it. He says He grabbed the booty and He shared it with all of us. And that's what's going on here. God has Jesus has grabbed the gifts, and He's given them to us. And those gifts are your pastors and your elders and your teachers and your ministers. Those are the gifts. And there's two things I want you to see from that. First of all, you are bringing glory to Christ. You are fulfilling His purpose of the temple by being, by receiving it. You see what you I want you to understand why you're in the church. You're in the church because Christ found you on the ground and polished you up and thought you would be beautiful in this particular place in His temple. And all you have to do to work the works of God, John chapter 6, Jesus was asked by these people who were so adamant. They just wanted so badly to do everything right. They woke up in the morning and Jesus was gone. And they searched over all the hills and they couldn't find Him. And they got in a boat and they went across the lake and they found Him. And they wanted so badly to do something for Jesus. To do something for God. And they said, "What do we have to do? We'll do it. We've already crossed land and sea today for you. What must we do to work the works of God?" And Jesus said, "Believe on the one that He sent. Receive it." All you have to do today to bring glory to Christ is receive it. All you have to do today when we go through our prayer of confession in a few minutes, and you're going to confess your sins, and you're going to... Everything in your body, every cell in your body is going to be saying, "And God, I won't do that again." And He's going to say, "Yeah, you will." Don't think that you're making any progress with me by promising not to do it again. Just believe that God loves sinners and receive it. Just believe on the one He has sent. That's what He is asking. He has put you exactly where He wants you to be put so that you'll catch the light exactly the way He wants you to catch it. Just receive it. And He also calls us to trust our ministers. He gives us ministers for a purpose. And I want you to understand this for a second. Our ministers, and this text applies to elders as well as pastors, are there for a reason. We exist to build people up for the ministry. And we can't help you if you won't let us. My wife and I were talking the other day, and she says, "You know, it doesn't seem like anybody you're really involved with is getting better." Well, I can't believe that shocks you. But part of the problem is, and it's not just me, I've talked to other friends who are pastors, part of the problem is nobody calls us until it's too late. I mean, it's essentially like this. Nobody calls, you know, the physician until they got cancer. You know, nobody calls their pastor until they've already moved out on each other. And the reason for that is you want so badly to believe that you're okay that you lie about the fact that you're okay to yourself. and to everybody else. And I want to encourage you. We want to pray for you. How are you going to call out to Jesus? Jesus says, the church is my body. You will call out to Jesus and invite Him into your life to minister to you by calling out to your church and asking for help. That is how you receive Christ. You're not going to find Him anywhere else. He's in His church. And I want to encourage you to make use of that. The first thing about this temple is it is around the image. It is around Christ. The second thing I want to make, and this is, I'm going to have to make it briefly, is the material of our unity is a common objective fact. That we are, in fact, a community. What does he say? He says, maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. For there is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to one hope that belongs to your call. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father over all, who is over all and through all and in all. What is he saying? He's not saying, go out there and form a unity. He's saying, hey, guess what? You are united. Recognize that. We don't build unity. We are united. Think of the television show that was so popular it got canceled, Arrested Development. Arrested Development is about this extremely dysfunctional family who hate each other. But they're poor now, so they got to live in one house. And there's just kind of this one guy who, in his self-righteousness, and it's really funny that he's self-aware about that, is trying to keep everybody together. Why is he keeping everybody together? Because we are, in fact, one family. We have one father, one set, one gene pool, one heritage. We are, in fact, one family. And what Paul is saying to us is, we are all the Church of Christ, the Universal Church of Christ, is, in fact, one church. Recognize that. We're joined together by one Lord. There's only one Jesus who has saved us. There's only one baptism in the name of Christ. There's only one faith, the faith of the gospel, that Jesus has come to save sinners. We are united. We need to recognize that. And what that means is there's a positive and a negative. We can't create unity by kind of watering down what we believe about God, because God is Himself our unity. Our doctrine, the Apostles' Creed that we recite every Sunday, is the point of
that better?
Well, how far did I get? I was ranting anyway. Let's just move on. Unity has to have content. It's not our content doesn't cause our disunity. We don't lose our unity by claiming and holding on to the truth of the gospel. It's the truth of the gospel that makes us one. Without that, we've got nothing to unite around. Does that make sense? Good. Let's move on then. It's also important to understand this. It is just as easy, just as possible, to use the truth of the gospel to destroy our unity. And our unity is something that we have to maintain, Paul says. It has to be important to us. It's very funny to me. The people who are the most adept, who seem to be the most interested in theology, also seems to be the ones who are willing to fight over anything, who won't use their unity to hold themselves together, who won't hold the Christ up. It's very funny. Let me give you an example. Big buzzword, predestination, all that kind of stuff. You can decide to fight over it or not, and all you have to do to decide to fight over it is insist on using the buzzwords. You know? I mean, I can preach to any crowd about the love of God, that came before I loved him. And people just love it. They're excited about it. It's great. It's a very encouraging message. And all you have to do is not insist on using those buzzwords of predestination. Who cares what the words are? It's very easy for us to puff ourselves up and to believe that we are better because we know the buzzwords. And therefore, instead of uniting people around the truth, we use the truth to crush people and separate them. And we have to recognize that that's a temptation. And we have to reject that temptation. It's very interesting. He uses baptism as something that we are united by. We're united by one baptism. Then why do we fight about it so much? I don't know everything there is to know about baptism, and you don't either. And if you really want to disturb somebody who's just adamant, passionate about getting baptism right, just look at them and go, I don't know. I believe in something called total depravity. Total depravity means that every aspect of my body and life and my mind has been affected by sin. I'm definitely wrong about something. Baptism might be it. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. So what? You going to kill me? Well, that's been done before in history. But let's not go there. We need to hold on to the truth. And the truth needs, but the truth has to unite us, not separate us. And when it separates us, it's because we have let go of Jesus. And we are letting truth be what gives us our value as humans. Instead of believing that Christ's love for us, Christ's love for a fallible, wrong sinner is what gives us our value as humans. Nothing else. That is the truth of the unity, the stones of unity, if you will. But stones never will make a temple. You've got to have very, very much mortar to make a temple. And I want to finish up by talking about that. The practice of our unity, what holds these pieces together around the image, is the mortar. Look how Paul begins this passage. He says, I urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. What's the glue that holds the stones together? What makes this temple? It's love. It's patience. It's long-suffering. He begins by saying, walk it with a manner that's worthy of your calling. Now, he's not saying, you were called by a righteous God, therefore be righteous, and you better be good enough to earn it. He's saying, be consistent. How were you saved? Were you saved because you were righteous? Were you saved and brought into the church by being right? No. You were saved by grace. So walk graciously. Walk in a manner that is consistent with your calling. If we go to a wedding and we see the bride-to-be wearing gym shorts, we think, well, gym shorts are fine. Not typically appropriate for a wedding. It's not consistent with a wedding. When we see Christians acting in a way that's judgmental or not gracious, we can say that's not consistent with being a Christian. It's not worthy of their calling. And just to bring out a few things, the primary thing is patience. I would love to go through the whole thing talking about humility, but I want to lay on this patience thing for a second. He says, I love the old King James version of this. He would say, with much long suffering. Now, I'm not a great biblical exegete, but I can't exegete the word long suffering with you. It means you're going to have to suffer long. That's what long-suffering means. And it means you're going to have to suffer long with me. We're going to have to suffer long with each other. We're going to have to be patient with each other, individually and as a body. Individually, we have to be patient. How long, for those of you who are Calvinists, how long did it take you to become a Calvinist? Did you read it one time and go, bam, got it. Yay, election, and me. Typically it takes at least 6 months of like tearful, angry, struggling with the Bible, especially over that big L in the middle, right? It's hard to get our minds around it. And then the second we submit to it, what happens?
We go tell our parents, and we give them about 5 good minutes. And if they're not converted, and they don't believe it, by the end of that conversation, we're yelling at them, and we don't like them anymore, and they're just idiots. And we go find all of our non-Calvinistic friends, and we tell them all this stuff, and we give them a good 10 minutes. And then we explain to them that if they don't like it, it's because they're sinners who have too much pride. It took me 6 months, but I'm giving you 6 minutes. That seems about right. We have no patience for each other. We have no patience with the body. Are you patient with the community? This church, if you stay with us any time at all, is going to disappoint you. I hope it does. If it doesn't disappoint you, then it's going to become an idol. And if it doesn't disappoint you, that means we're going to be filled with perfect people. And I want a church that's filled with sinners, that's continually reaching out to lost people and to broken people and to people who don't know how to act in church. And if we want a community of people like that, then they're going to do things wrong. And you're occasionally going to get a cold shoulder. And you're occasionally not going to get the pastoral response that you're expecting. We're sinners. Can you be patient with the body? We have to practice unity. We have to maintain it as something that's important. Be eager to maintain unity. And finally, look at the end of chapter 5. I'm ending the passage. Sorry. I've got too many things going on. It says, the two final steps, there's peace, there's patience. The second ingredient in the mortar is maturity, and the third ingredient is truth. The second ingredient, maturity. Maturity in service and doctrine. What does it say? In verse 11, Jesus gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, and teachers to equip the saints for the work of ministry. How do we maintain unity? By doing the work of ministry. You understand that as long as we are here together, doing something together, then we will be united, working for a purpose. But the second you begin wondering why you're not, you stop coming here to serve. The second you stop coming here to do anything but get entertained. Let me rephrase this: the second you begin to come here to get entertained or to get your needs met, instead of coming here to serve, you will stop liking it. In 1926, there was an enormous flood in Mississippi. The levee broke in Greenville. The entire city was underwater for the whole spring, for two and a half months. And when I say underwater, I mean, like, there would be 2 or 3 feet of water on the second floor of their house. Okay? Underwater. And people were kind of grouped up in hills and living in tents and boating around to see each other. And the guy who was kind of in charge of the relief project was named William Alexander Percy and wrote a book about it called Lanterns on the Levee. And in that book, he says this. He says, for the first 2 weeks of that period, everybody in Greenville, that we embodied the selfless paragon of service. Everybody was just going to each other's house, helping each other, pulling furniture out, saving people's food, saving their crops, saving their lives. But he says something changed. And by the end of it, it was like a war. And he said, after it was over, he tried to figure out, why did it change? When did it change? When did people start bickering and fighting? And he put his finger on the calendar day when the Red Cross arrived with the help packages. And then all of a sudden, everybody stopped saying, what can I do to help my neighbor? And everybody started saying, what can I do to get what's mine? And that attitude of getting what's mine caused the division and the war. And the same is true for us. If we want to maintain unity, then it has to be maintained through service. It has to be maintained through service. It has to be maintained through doctrine, by growing in our knowledge. What does he say in verse 13? Until we attain to the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, so that we may no longer be children tossed to and fro by the waves, and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by human cunning and craftiness and deceitful schemes. We have to mature in doctrine enough that we're not going to be carried around by every new thought that comes into the air. I got a text message the other day from one of my colleagues, somebody who took my place at Delta State as the RUF campus minister. And he wrote to me, and he said he was tired of hearing Sarah Palin was Esther. And I said, I had no idea Sarah was Esther. And he said, yes, and Obama is the Antichrist because we know the Antichrist has Muslim roots in Revelation. Well, do you see how false doctrine causes schism? I mean, if Obama's a Democrat, then that's one thing. And we can argue about that, and who cares? But if he is the Antichrist, I've got to vote against him. I think we would all agree for that, right? Now, he's not. You know that, right? Because the Antichrist isn't interested in the United States. He's interested in the church. And if you don't understand that, then we need to have a long talk about the Bible. And seriously, I want you to understand that. The church is the enemy of Satan, not the United States. But understand this. False teaching always does that. It wants to elevate something. It wants to call something Satan. You have to be against it to be with me. This is going to destroy the world. False teaching causes divisions, and we have to mature and get to a point where we understand the truth and we're able to see through the newest thing coming on. And that's probably the biggest condemnation of the American church. Is that we're always seeking after the next big thing. The next thing that's going to fix all things. We have to mature beyond that. And finally, we maintain unity by speaking the truth in love. And I wish I had time to just fully bear this out, but I've already gone too long. Speaking the truth in love. Let me just summarize it real quickly for you. Speak the truth in love. Like enough. Some of us need to learn to say the truth. And sometimes we have people who want to come and dump all their problems on us, and we need to be able to tell them the truth. And the truth is that they're looking for the world to satisfy them, and the world will never satisfy them. You're looking to your career or to your husband or to your children or to your school to solve your problems and to be Jesus for you. And it never will. And we need to be able to speak that truth to each other and say only Jesus is going to fulfill you. We have to speak it in love. And others of us are all too quick to use the truth like a hammer. A few years ago, somebody quit coming to the ministry, and that was fine. That happens. I'm not for everybody. And this is when I was still a campus minister. And I found out later this person was mad at me. And I heard through a friend, well, you know, that she had opened her heart up and bared her soul to you, and you said nothing in response. And I said to this friend who was telling me this, I said, well, that's interesting. Her bearing her soul felt a lot like her kicking the stew out of me. That's what it felt like. Now, to her, it may have felt like she was opening her heart. But to me, it felt like she was kicking the snot out of me. And I didn't know how to respond other than say, thanks, bye. And we have to learn how to share the truth with people without venting. And I would encourage you to ask yourself that question. If you're about to share the truth with somebody, are you doing it to punish them? Are you making them the cause of everything that's gone wrong for you recently? The truth is not a hammer. And if I'm not saying this in love, in the desire to build you up and to build up Christ, I probably just need to be quiet. We're one church. We're here for Jesus. We're saved by one God. And everything that we say and we do is held together to point back toward Him. Let's go before that Lord now and pray.